assume there's no world. It, like, the worst case scenario that you could come up with is not the ending of Get Out. Yeah. Like, there's no part of him, like, he knows something is bad. He knows this is not safe and he's alone, but it's still like, there's still a chance I could get out.
I'm Kat.
And I'm Gabe.
And we're
the Ghouls Next Door. And we'll treat you like family.
We have fun, really.
No, we really will. Now pretend. We won't put our family members into your bodies.
Yeah, because that'd be fucked up.
That would pretty mess up.
That would be bad.
Not a bold assumption, I don't think at all.
No, I don't think so at all. Yeah.
We have the Media Literacy Show from a Horror Lens, where we explore the real life, historical, and psychological reasonings behind our cinematic fears. And today we're talking about Get Out.
Mm-hmm.
The Jordan Peele original, one that shooketh the horror world. One of the best, I wouldn't even just say horror movies, just one of the best movies to exist. It's also got like some art house horror that I think there's a lot of appreciation for some of the other horror directors. And so he really defined himself as a horror director with this piece. We've credited it quite a lot in our show and on interviews and other things as really kind of revitalizing the political horror movement, although it's with the understanding that like horror has always been political. Right? This is just like a mainstream one that people understood that it was political and like respected it for being political and also as a horror movie.
Yeah, it got to be both.
Yeah.
Did it win awards? I feel like yes, right?
It was in the issue is that it was dubbed a comedy.
Oh.
So that's the category that it was put in.
Okay.
And
so it wasn't recognized as horror in the award space.
Which, like, there are so many, we've said this ad nauseum, that there's so many horror films out there that really do deserve quite profound awards, and there's just not any respect for horror as a genre, considering how much work it does in, like, you know, helping us with trauma and also like, you know, expressing the fears, anxieties, and history of audiences everywhere in a way that, like, you know, drama
it's even like comedy empathy builder in a way that, like, in a way that I don't always see in other genres. Like, it really does like impact in a way that activates the parts of your brain that would be receptive to that. That you might not get in a comedy because you're just like, it's a fun time. It activates that.
I absolutely agree that horror can really unlock a lot of things, and it doesn't get any respect. And this film kind of, I think, started a lot of conversations and started for people to realize the power of media. And it's also just beautiful and also just a brilliant and good horror film.
Yeah. The intentionality just like comes through in every single aspect of it.
Yeah. And I'll definitely talk about it. And we've talked about it. Like when people try to, address certain traumas or issues in society, and then they do it from a place that isn't of care, and so they end up harming people. Yeah. And it's also like, what's the purpose of this? What are you trying to do besides just like, you know, get a rise out of an audience? And this isn't that. This is like very genuine and caring, and also not holding back.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And I'm so thankful for it. This is going to be a very long episode for our listeners. There's a lot to unpack. As you recall, last week when we were talking about Us, that was really tough to find one thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this one, it's pretty clear what this is about, really, right? It's like racism and the fact that it's not gone, right? Yeah. It's not gone and that there's new faces to be worried about. And also, like, I wonder even... Because at the time that it was made, right, the Obama administration, like a Trump era Get Out would look even more different because they ain't hiding anymore. Yeah. They're not even pretending. It's very obvious what the film is about. It's not trying to pretend to be any, or it's not trying to do a lot of things the way that Us was. Yeah. Us has a lot of hats to wear and it does a great job with all of them. But this will be long for a different reason because there's just so much to say.
Yeah.
And I can't say that I'll bring, you know, a lot of new things to the table, but if you for some reason have been either living under a rock or something else has been keeping you from Get Out, I would say overcome whatever that is, because honestly it is one of the it's such a great film and the horror is, you know, more psychological, so that part can be something that you're interested in. I understand maybe not wanting to protect yourself so you don't watch it, so I'll tell you all about it. I'll tell you some cool things I thought were there in the making of the film. I think there's probably many a film studies class that now includes Get Out, and the fact that you have like a horror film on the, you know, syllabus is phenomenal.
Yeah, I found like in my research just so many like articles written by like people who are in their like education journey. So it's definitely like theses being written about the film. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, give me a job. I can talk about horror all the time and tell you all the very interesting things that you could learn.
Yeah.
But all right, let me jump in. So Get Out is from 2017, which feels like a million years ago.
Yeah, it was very long ago. It feels so old from now.
It really does. It was pretty long ago. So it is about a young African-American visits his white girlfriend's parents for the weekend, where his simmering uneasiness about the reception of him eventually reaches a boiling point and is directed by Jordan Peele. What a subtle way to explain this film. It reaches a boiling point, for sure. So let me tell you what happens. There will be spoilers in this episode, as per the usual. This is a film where pretty much everybody knows the spoiler. Same thing with Us. Like, that's not really where I would say watching it the first time, watching Get Out the first time, and the reveal was intense. So
yeah,
if you've somehow avoided knowing what happens and you've never watched it, please go watch it as a first time and then come back to Us. If you have watched it, you know the deal. So let's talk about what happens in Get Out. So Get Out is a film that effectively blends horror, comedy, and social commentary into a genuinely brilliant horror film. Following Chris, a young black photographer who is going to meet his white girlfriend's parents for the first time. And inspired by Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a film in which a black man meets the parents of his white girlfriend. It's almost like... Peele mentions that's part of the inspiration. It's very much like, what if that was scarier? What if all the like subtle fears were loud? You know, he loves saying the quiet part out loud. That's, I'm pretty sure what his podcast is called, Quiet Part Out Loud. And then Out There Screaming is their anthology film, book, which I have.
Nice.
The couple in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner are wealthy liberals, and throughout the film, they must address the latent racism their relationship brings to light when interacting with her parents, who vehemently oppose the relationship. So it's very similar where these are people of status. They've lived in this, like, you know, expectation that it's okay. And then they encounter parents who are like, absolutely not. And they're like, whoa, really? This time, this day and age, which was a long time ago. So for us to be like, this day and age? And in a skillful blend of dramedy and absurd, Peele takes this plot and adds a second storyline reminiscent of Stepford Wives and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So that's where we get the horror kind of section of that. So Chris's girlfriend, Rose, seems unaware of the stress Chris is experiencing at this impending meeting, not entirely understanding his caution. And on the other end of the spectrum is Chris's best friend, Rob, who serves as like comic relief throughout the film. And he's a comical TSA agent who is immediately against the meeting altogether. And he warns Chris that Rose's family and people like them, example, rich white people, be making people into weird sex slaves and shit. He just flat out is like, listen, that's what they be doing out there. And of course, like, we can laugh that off because it's an absurd scenario. And it's that parallel right in the beginning of like her being like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say my black boyfriend is coming to dinner. And he's like, but why didn't you? Like, she doesn't, like, she appears to not understand why that even needs to come up because, you know, she's colorblind. Mm-hmm. She just sees Chris. Right? She doesn't see color. And that's the problem.
That's, the answer is she doesn't.
She absolutely does see color. She absolutely, But as far as we know at that time, she just sees Chris for Chris. She loves him. It's her first black boyfriend. The film unfolds with a fluid blend of comedy and discomfort. Though Rose's family aren't loud racists, their prejudices and innate racism speaks volumes. When Rose's father, Dean, tries to paint himself an ally, a white liberal, and asks, how long has this whole thing been going on? This thing. Chris smiles in a way. He says a number of terrible things, including the fun, like, I would have voted for Obama a third time if I could, which she makes a joke of in the beginning, and then he does say it, and you laugh at it because you're like, ha, ha, people be like that. And later, during an annual party featuring a plethora of uppity rich white people, what unfolds is a tense, uncomfortable, and at times truly terrifying series of events, including like a moment where Chris goes upstairs and everyone stops talking. Yeah. And then they look up and they're like, you're like, what the F? What? So starting slowly with odd comments on Chris's body, his history, and his blackness, Chris flexes those fine-tuned code-switching muscles with every outrageous question, touch, or assumption, and to every microaggression, Chris meets it with a smile and a laugh. He's incredibly uncomfortable. And we've talked about Get Out and Us in our two-part Jordan Peele episode, and we talk about how there was that need for Chris to laugh off, and the fact that he ended up in this dangerous situation because, despite like those red flags and all the alarm bells going off, he couldn't do anything about it. Like those are always going off. There's always red flags, and you have to just like shrug them off or play it cool, even if it's detrimental to your own health. And it's kind of like the way that he interacts with the cop in the beginning, how he's just like compliant. He's like, here, I'll give you my ID. And she's the one who's outraged. That's how he operates with everyone is a cop that we need to be like de-escalating for, because they're not going to do it. So as absurd as the interactions are, and as infuriating as Chris's reluctance to do anything about it, Peele's horror seeps into every interaction, leaving our hair on end. Though we don't know what, we know something is up. Again, they all stop talking, and they say absurd things, and you're like, you're also laughing uncomfortably. You're like, oh, God. Like, if that happened in real life, oh, my God. Eventually, the canary in the coal mine, Rob, finally gets through to Chris. After Chris ran into another black man at the party who was acting quite peculiar, that's the best way to explain it, he attempts to get a photo of him. And the flash causes the man to have a frightening reaction where he urges Chris to get out. Rob quickly responds to the picture, saying that the man has been missing for some time and his name is actually Andre, not Logan. He's definitely not in a relationship with this old white lady. I told you they've been making them into weird sex slaves and shit. Get out of the house. So Chris urges Rose to leave, who complies before turning on him in one of the best film reveals ever. It's one of my favorite moments in the film because it's like chaos and you know he's like... He doesn't trust her. He found a bunch of pictures. Clearly she's not.
Yeah, he found the box. He does not trust her. Yeah. But at the same time, it's like, I built this whole relationship up.
Well, you don't want to believe that. Scene.
Yeah, you don't want, you want it to think that it's okay.
You would not assume. There's no world. It, like, the worst case scenario that you could come up with is not the ending of Get Out. Yeah. Like, there's no part of him, like, he knows something is bad, he knows this is not safe and he's alone, but it's still like, I could, there's still a chance I could get out. I like like, she's not evil.
Yeah, no, yeah, they don't think that exactly.
Yeah, like, he knows something's,
they don't think there's a basement with experiments.
Yeah. There's not, this isn't supervised, you know. And that's kind of the brilliance of it too, right? And I think his genuine, like, he knows something's up. He knows, first of all, he's not her first black boyfriend. Second of all, he saw two pictures of people who have been walking around the house. So that's something wrong. So he knows something has occurred to those people and to Andre, right? He just doesn't know. He just knows, like, he's in danger. And when she is, like, panicking, like, I'm looking. And he's like, Rose, where are those keys? Like, that, like, stop. Because at first he's like, you know, he shouts at her. And then there's a moment of, like, that defeat. And then when she pulls it out, like, you know, I can't give you those, Chris. I was like, no! You're kidding. So honestly, one of the best film reveals in the world. That's what I was saying. Like, Don't Worry, Darling did not have that. Like, I knew that Jack wasn't shit. Okay. So when he turned, I was just like, what is this pathetic worm, man? I don't care. Like, I knew he was, he's an idiot. He's not conspiring it. Like, it just didn't have the flare. It didn't have the fire, and nothing could. So turns out Rob was right. And in a way, the Armitages are turning people into sex slaves. You know, they're trying to get that lady, that creepy lady, a black husband. That's what Andre was being for that lady. So through absurd science, they have discovered a way to transfer the consciousness of their people, the Order of the Coagula, it's fun, into the bodies they deem superior, which just so happens to be black bodies, right? There's a conversation in the beginning where Dean Armitage, it mentions that his dad was a runner and was beat out at the Olympics in a really, and he has like this whole moment. He's like, yeah, you know, he lives up there, like with his like Aryan race bullshit. And then he gets beat out by a black man. And it's like this whole thing. But without like explaining that, like, he took the wrong thing away from that. Yeah. Right. It wasn't like an understanding of the power and like appreciation of like different races. Instead, it was like, oh, OK, we should have that one then. We just need their body and then we'll be cool. So, having held a silent auction earlier in the day, Chris has been promised to a member of the Coagula. He is sent to a subconscious hellscape called the Sunken Place, which is accessed via hypnotism by Rose's mother, Missy, who is a psychotherapist. Though Chris avoids the Sunken Place and in a riveting third act, fights his way through white people in white and black bodies to escape. In the final moments of the film, Chris kneels above Rose as she lays dying, shot in the gut by him, and he is tired, mentally exhausted, and hopeless when a wash of red and blue lights pour over him. And audiences everywhere, like, your stomach drops. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, fuck. You assume he's done for, with the police here to take him away. But then you breathe a sigh of relief, because it's actually Rob here to save him, thank God, in his little TSA vehicle. And now that you know what happens, let's dive into the film and why I think it's one of the best films made in the history of filmmaking, and not just horror, but just like as a film. That's why it's in all those studies. So Stepford Wives is to feminism what Get Out is to racism. So, as I mentioned earlier, Peele was greatly inspired by Stepford Wives, the original film, and the book by Ira Levins. And also, like, A Little Rosemary's Baby, also by Ira Levins, Invasion of Body Snatchers, all them. He also has, like, a lot of motifs and references. He does this all the time to The Shining and other horror greats, because he's just in great appreciation of horror as a genre. So both films, Stepford Wives and Get Out, feature a photographer, talented and independent, who is betrayed by their partner. For Joanna and Stepford, this betrayal comes from her husband wanting to turn her into a perfect housewife and a robot sex slave. For Chris, Rose doesn't even want his body. It's for somebody else. So Rose, like the husbands and Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby, is manipulative and seems like an ally until the very end. Like they both films do that thing where it's like they're not great, but they might also be a victim. Right.
Yeah.
By their ignorance. And thanks to The Take, which is a really great resource for like analyzing film, they highlighted some of the similarities between Stepford Wives and Get Out, because it's been a long time since we watched Stepford Wives. It's like 2020. I don't even know. So they say Rose's true allegiance is to her class and the privilege she's happy to enjoy. So not to Chris at all. No. The Take also remarks on the sinister absurdity of the technology and plot for both Peele and Levin. So in the film, the horror is revealed as something absurd, outrageous, and exaggerated to exert control over the protagonists, women in Stepford Wives and Black people in Get Out. However, in society, the control doesn't come from science fiction surgery, but instead subtle control that holds power over others, like laws or restrictions or social understanding, right? All those subtle things that are just ingrained in the way we operate, or I don't know, our prison system. While Stepford Wives speaks to feminist issues and absurdifies the threat of the patriarchy in Stepford, Connecticut, Peele uses Get Out to sound the alarm on the racism in our country as a whole. The treatment of Chris throughout the film isn't new. It isn't unexpected, but the gross science experiment is an exaggerated representation of the harms of white liberals in our country. So that's the connection. All right, so let's talk about showcasing Black history and trauma without being dramatic. Peele skillfully weaves Black horror, fears, and history into the film. With each watch, I notice new things in the set design, the music, the wardrobe, everything. Here are some things to consider that I'm sure you've caught yourself or heard somewhere. So firstly, obviously, is the silent auction. In the middle of the film, the Order of the Coagula, which is this group of white people now putting their minds and consciousness into black bodies, holds a silent auction disguised as a silent game of bingo. This is reminiscent, obviously, of slave auctions of America's past, as Chris's black body is literally being sold off by somebody else who claims to own him. Right? The Armitages are like, this is ours, we caught it, and now you buy it for whatever reasons. There's the cotton in the chair. So the way that Chris escapes the operation and avoids the sunken place is that he stuffs his ears with cotton from the chair that he's tied to. The leather has been ripped away because Chris has this like relentless scratching that he does when he's in a traumatic experience. It's like a coping mechanism that we see him do earlier in the film when he's first put into the sunken place. So this could be a reference to picking cotton, a common practice for enslaved people, only now the cotton is saving Chris's life. And it also made me think of Odysseus and his fight against the sirens in Greek mythology and using that idea of like closing our ears to avoid the siren's call. I was like, that's great.
Yeah.
I love a good, you know, Odyssey reference. There's the fact that the Armitage's house is a plantation style home equipped with their own black servants. And though these black servants are inhabited by the elder Armitages, the bodies they are using are black. Right. So the black bodies are commodities and part of the property. The original people are not there. They're just objects for these crusty white people. Code switching. Yeah. So Chris puts up with so much more than we think he should, because most of this is normal, unfortunately, like some of the awful things that they say. Chris is not naive or easily manipulated. He's just used to silencing the alarms. And saying the alert, right? When the white people arrive, they all arrive in black cars in a row, like a funeral procession, and they're dressed like a funeral too. So that was just like a little Mm-hmm. Like, they're ready. There's a lot of culty things, obviously, because it is a cult. The deer. Yeah. So the deer motif comes up a lot in the film. So first we see a deer hit when Chris, which represents Chris, obviously, in danger and as prey. They hit them at the beginning, and that's when we first meet the cop. We also learn later that Chris's mom died after hitting a deer in the resulting accident. So that's just a incredibly touching moment for him. Like, it's a traumatic experience to relive. Dean mm-hmm. Armitage, the dad, remarks that all deer should be killed. They are taken over and should be put down. He's like, it's gotten out of control. They're useless.
Yeah.
Which is this unsubtle commentary on how he feels about Black people. It's so obvious. It's gross.
Yeah.
Chris encounters a deer in the sunken place made of bone, serving as a warning. And then lastly, Chris uses the stag head, which was originally mounted as a trophy, right? Again, representing Chris and the Armitage's intentions, but it is now a weapon. So there's a lot of, like, we're repurposing things that have been used to harm us or historically harmed us. And then he, like, mm-hmm. impales him. Yeah. There's the teacup. I found this great study guide on medianight.org. I'll get out media. I'll link it in the blog. But they had a few little references and things that I was like, I don't really think about that. Like the teacup. So the way that Missy hypnotizes people is that she, like, does this, like, circling with her teacup. And it's like, shoo, shoo. Yeah. And then she'll, like, click it. She'll, like, think, think. I read somewhere that it was, like, that's what, like, slave owners would do. Like, you know, if they had, like slaves in the home, it'd be like a think, think, and they'd know to come and serve them. But I don't know if that's true. But in this thing, they mentioned that the teacup and spoon that Missy uses as a hypnosis tool has a dual meaning. It is often seen as a symbol of civility and politeness, but the tea industry was founded on violent colonialism in Southeast Asia and everywhere. We have the Boston Tea Party right here. But this, you know, attempt to control tea has caused lots of pain. So it's kind of like this duality of, like, it's, you know, we're upper class, we're important. And then also, but we murdered a bunch of people to get this tea in the first place.
Yep.
The act of separating her milk from the colored Fruit Loops, like a fucking freak, is clearly segregation. This is something that Rose does in the end after she's, like, given up the
facade
of being his girlfriend. She wears, like, all white, and she's, like, you know, she's definitely, like, the femme fatale, like the Bunny Boiler type personality all of a sudden. And she, like, she's, like, scrolling for a new, like, she's looking at, like, basketball players. She's like, who is my new target? It's so weird. But yeah, it's besides the fact that it is weird, like, it's absurd. If I saw someone eating cereal separately, I'd be like, I can never interact with this person ever again. That person's a psychopath. But it's very obviously, like, it was colored Fruit Loops and her white milk.
Yep.
Can't even touch. Rose and Chris are often wearing red, white, and blue, which I didn't really notice.
Me neither, yeah.
She also wears blue. In the beginning, she's wearing a jean dress, but Chris never wears red because red is associated with the cults, or just cults in general. So that same helpful study guide mentions that all of the Armitages and their guests wear red, which is a symbol of their secret society. And it's all like a pocket square might be red or a red scarf or something, right? So red, of course, is associated with blood, and they don't mind spilling lots of it to get what they want. Chris, however, wears no red whatsoever, and this is one of the things that marks him as an outsider. The scene at the family gathering, we see the motif of the color red being a representative of the hidden society. Everyone at the party is wearing something red while Chris is wearing blue. This represents his status as an outsider and the us versus them mentality. And also there's, like, the fact that Rose and Chris are wearing red, white, and blue. It's just like the American flag. Like, there, I'll show the picture, but there's, like, one of him in his jean shirt. And then she's wearing a red and white striped shirt. Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, whatever, they got clothes. But it was intentional from the costume designer. So
yeah,
The sunken place, right, acts to push him down and silence him. It's essentially this black void where he watches the world from a tiny screen, like, which is his eyes, right? But he is no longer in control. He's now a passenger in his own body. So the intent is to remove his autonomy and vision. And it's also the audience, right? The sunken place is both a theater surrounded in darkness and watched through a tiny screen separated from the content, and also represents the detached black experience. So thinking of, like, the fact that Chris puts up with so much is because he can't always be there, be present, and react in the way that other people can, right? Peel wants us to leave the sunken place, us being the audience. He wants us to wake up and get out, wake up to the truth and to learn from Chris's mistakes, no longer laughing off the subtle cruelties and aware of the real threats. So he, like, it looks like a theater for a reason. It's supposed to be like, this is you guys, wake up, right? Chris's camera photography and the commodification of his experiences is also a thing that comes through throughout the film. So Chris is a photographer, and it's reminiscent of the protagonist in Stepford Wives, and he is very talented, and his work is an expression of himself and his community. It's the first thing we see in the film is his work. Right. Mm-hmm. And he uses his camera as a way to keep himself safe and detached from the subtle horrors around him. When he views the white people through the lens, their words become more preposterous and mean. And he kind of uses it, like, to separate himself. Like, he can look through this lens and he's not, like, fully present. And his flash also frees two of the black men from the sunken place. Like the fact that he does it for Andre and then Grandpa. I don't know what Grandpa's real name was. But yeah, that, like, there's a strength in that. Also, the person who buys him at the auction doesn't even care that he's black. It's not really about that. For him, he wants his eyes. He wants those things that you see through. But that, like, has Chris's eyes and his view, right? The way that he sees the world is his strength, right? Is his independence. It's his power. And so taking that is super cruel. Redbone by Childish Gambino. This is the first song we hear in the film. It starts with singer and actor Childish Gambino, Donald Glover, who urges the listeners to stay woke, which is a phrase which has become associated with the Black Lives Matter movement and indicates a consciousness of racial prejudice and discrimination in America. But it's also an urging for Chris to stay aware of the dangers around him, as it also warns him that they're going to find you and going to catch you sleeping. It's such a great, he, like, Peele's just great at that anyway, of including music and kind of being not so subtle about them. There's also the last thing I'll say about some of the film, like, things. This is actually more of a language thing, which I'm about to get into, but Rob references Jeffrey Dahmer, and it's not an accident that that's the serial killer he chose to reference, because he's just like, it might be like, you know, like Jeffrey Dahmer or something. He says it kind of as a joke, but it's also real. But even though he's saying it in jest, Jeffrey Dahmer is specifically a serial killer who sought out black and brown boys for his own sick reasons. Like, he had very specific reasons for seeking them out. There are a lot of disenfranchised, vulnerable people, so they didn't get any help. And he was most harmful to black communities and is known for eating and experimenting on his victims. So that is an intentional choice of serial killers. Because he could have said Ted Bundy. But he did. He specifically said that. They're both pieces of crap. But language is also super important in the film, serving as both foreshadowing and confessions of a character's true intentions, such as Dean's rant on the deer population. But some other things I caught in my many rewatches were Dean says something like, in the beginning, he's given the tour and he's like, it feels like there's a piece of grandmother in the kitchen, like. And then they walk in a little and Georgina's right there, which is like, spoilers, that's grandma. So it's like, I feel like there's a piece of grandma still here. I like cackled. But that's something you wouldn't catch if you weren't, like, you didn't know.
You
were just like, it's scary, because it is like a jump scare moment, because she's just standing there like, hi, I'm here to help you, and you're like, oh. Rob also mentions the robot sex slaves, which is exactly what Stepford Wives are in the first one. Yeah. That's what they're trying to do. It's like really silly. The main title is called Tsitsilitsa Kwa Wahenga, and I'm totally probably butchering that. I apologize. I don't speak Swahili, but it means listen to the elders in Swahili. And the translation to the words throughout are brother, run, listen to the elders, listen to the truth, run away, save yourself. And in some of the study guides and things I was reading, it was like obviously Swahili, because it would be like a native language, but also because we, like the way that our ancestors communicate with us is usually in this disconnected way, right? Like we get the energy, we get the vibes of what they would be doing to us, but we can't always understand like exactly what they're saying. So there would be still that barrier of like translation. The wrong language used by Black people in the film, who are actually white people, is a great way to unsettle the viewers and keep them aware of something being off. Like even the fact that like Andre didn't know to like pound it like the thing. I'm sorry, Logan. And just the eeriness of grandpa talking to him, just like, she's one heck of a gal, isn't she? And you're like, what the F? And I think of the short story, Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been, by Joyce Carol Oates, which is one of my favorites, where a young girl encounters a strange man who uses outdated language and is later revealed to be the devil. But like as she's talking to him, she's like, why are you saying that? Like, that's old. Like, no one says that anymore, old man. But he's like performing human. So like there's little subtleties that you're like, that's weird. Like, he's standing weird. And so like that, whenever language is outdated language is used, I think of that and I'm like, what's up with that? And then also is like, people keep treating Chris like an other. Like the point when they kind of like corner him and they're like, do you like being Black? Like, do you feel like being Black is cool? Or like, I forget what they say, but it's like really loud and stupid. And he like gestures to Logan to be like, can you contribute to this conversation? Cause you're also a fellow Black man. And he's like, I love being Black. It's such a pleasant experience. But like, clearly like, Chris is like, why are they treating me differently than the other Black people here? And he even says like, I was feeling comfortable, like, you know, I felt more at ease because you were here because of the code switching thing. And then he realizes he can't uncode switch with these people. It's a whole thing. And then the last thing I'll say, and I'm sure there's so many more, please tell me. Please comment and be like, he also says this thing and it means this, because I love that stuff. But the last thing I caught and it made me cackle was that tour. The tour says so much. But he says, oh, don't go into the basement. Dean says this to Chris, because there's Black mold in there. And it's because there's a mold for Black people. The science experiments. So it's, again, unsubtle AF. Here's a brief on the white liberal problem. The Kat is going to go into way more detail in, but I did want to just like mention a few things because I was in that place in my brain. So, and because like that's the point of this film. Firstly, Peele was strategic in choosing this family and the behaviors of them and their friends as the villains, right? So Peele has spoken in interviews about working to address the post-racial lie, that's what he called it, that we found ourselves living in during the Obama administration. He wanted to show that racism was still very much alive and well, and just as harmful, if not more, when wielded quietly by the white elite liberals, right? So just as Kat has explained often in our show, almost constantly, right? It is dangerous to other or monstrous-sized people as it disconnects us from their actions and allows us to ignore responsibility, right? If we say they're a monster, we're humans. So we're in no way capable of doing such monstrous things. But then we're not privy to the fact that that is just a person too, and that people are capable of harm, right? Anybody is capable of harm. So by not choosing to have these villains be right-wing nut jobs, neo-Nazis or rednecks or just like the obvious villains, he removed the ability to monstrosize them in that way, to be like, well, those are just ignorant assholes, right? Those are just the, you know, Sisters of the Confederacy or whatever, you know, like brush it off. And I know that I've met people like the Armitages before, right? Have you? Kat, listeners, like, you have, right? You've talked to someone like that.
Yeah, but honestly, if you're a white person, you also have relatives that do that.
Yeah.
And you have to call them out all the time. So
I dated someone and their whole family was kind of like that. Like, I peep, like, they were this family. Like, watching it the first time, I was like, I've been in this house. Like, I've been in this house and I've had that, like, the laugh and, like, the discomfort. And, like, I am light skinned, right? So it was like, imagine if I wasn't. Like, if I was, like, my Florida color, it might be a little different as things are going on. So, but yeah, absolutely. I've met the Armitages before walking around. Same thing, out of pocket. In that, again, referencing that great study guide I found, Peel said he wrote them as the kind of people I'd meet at parties who were eager to tell me they voted for Obama, but whose attitudes can be considered just as patronizing and as dehumanizing as those of more obvious racists. It's even more dangerous because they aren't, like, they're pretending, right? They're hiding it. Right. Mm-hmm. So the Armitages and the Order of the Coagula would think they aren't racist. Actually, they would imagine the world is post-racial. And the proof that shows that they're not racist is the fact that they chose black bodies. Didn't they? Like, they couldn't be racist if they think black bodies are good enough for their experiments, right? Sure. However, this appreciation for black bodies is specifically through the lens of controlling and using the bodies, right? There's no autonomy, there's no actual, like, humanity that's involved in that. They would think that appreciating in any way the black bodies they couldn't, that the black bodies that they're intending to use, that they couldn't be racist. And it reminds me of that, like, comment I made about how Olivia Wilde must have been like, well, wouldn't it be more racist if I didn't cast this woman as Margaret who dies and is ignored by all the white women? You know, like, I feel like that's where her, like, she'd be like, it'd be more racist if I was worried about that, right? Like, let's colorblind cast it. And it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, we said this so many times. As soon as you cast a black person in a film like that, you have to consider what that does, because it does change the narrative completely. The same way, like, you know, George Romero did not intend to have a black protagonist in Day of the Dead, but it changed the whole story when he gets gunned down by militia at the end.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah, it's a whole thing, but I'll get into my section. But it's just a lack of self-awareness that's, like, really essential into that. And, like, your motivation too, where it's like, why do you not want to be perceived as racist? Is it so people will like you, or because you actually care?
That's super real. I love it. Yeah.
And you have to shift that in order to do a lot of that deprogramming.
Yeah, because if you see it, like, because the system is racist, right? Like, we all have things that we have to unlearn, societal things that you just, like, grow up believing or understanding, even without you knowing that fully, right? And so if you act, like, affronted, right? Like, insulted, right? You're kind of taking responsibility for it too, like, in that way. Like, if you're like, I'm not right, it's like, we all are.
Everyone is.
That's what race, that's what it is. It's a system.
For a lot of
it. It's not a person. It's a system of oppression. So we have to acknowledge that first and then be like, okay, I'm trying to unlearn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so exactly. Thanks, Kat. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was this idea of Black trauma versus Black horror, because I think Get Out is a brilliant social commentary film that effectively scares us without re-traumatizing us, right? So earlier in the season, while talking about culture shock, we discussed the appreciation we had for the delicate care taken with the content of the film, given the reality that reality around these issues are so horrifying, right? Peele was also incredibly caring in his execution of the message. And I've mentioned often in the show this idea of asking, who is this for, when we're watching a horror film? That's media literacy 101, right? Intent. A part of that question of, like, who is this for, is what is the intent of the film? Because knowing what the film wants to achieve can help us understand who it's for and how we should feel about it. quite honestly, right? And if the film's intention is to educate an unknowledgeable audience, like an ignorant audience, and reveal the horrors of a community, horrors a community is facing, then it most likely isn't for me and others like me, because we'd be living it. Like, I don't need that. Like, I don't need it in that way, right? And it runs the risk of re-traumatizing us and the folks who are in it, and most likely does not add anything new to the dialogue. It's just trying to catch people up. However, if the film is for us and by us, then we can have a film that offers us catharsis. And I watched this phenomenal video, highly, highly recommend for y'all. It's going to be linked here, by Princess Weeks, titled Black Trauma versus Black Horror, where she essentially reads my mind. I was like, thank you. And she addresses the problem, like problems with films like Antebellum and Them, or media like Antebellum and Them, because Them was a show. But these are two pieces of media that the Goals have intentionally not covered. I threw out the option of Antebellum, and it was quickly like, no. We don't have to always cover the bad stuff. These films are sensational at best and unnecessary at worst, and putting Black harm in history on display for shock value, not catharsis and healing. She said something that really stuck with me. She said, catharsis in horror is for the victim, not the perpetrator. Yeah. I was like, thanks, damn. And that feeling is for us. And when a film is made with us in mind, it can be freeing, providing a release of tension and fear. But when we're in the wrong, when it's in the wrong hands, like we as the audience are in the wrong hands and with the wrong intentions, the film can result in further harm. Princess Week also mentions, like she has a full discussion about the location, like the role of suburbs in horror and the history of subjugating that, like in the classic horror film People Under the Stairs, which one day we will cover. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's getting remade by Monkey Paw Productions. So it'll definitely come up. So she has a whole commentary on mental health in horror and more. And I highly, highly recommend a watch. Give it some looks. Originally, Peel had an ending in which Rob does not come to Chris's rescue, right? And this is where the trauma, I think, would have come. Instead, in that first ending, which is the alternate ending, it's a white cop, which I believe is the cop from the beginning, who locks him up. And it's a depressing ending, and one that the audience was undoubtedly expecting. It's the same that thought we had when we saw the red and blue lights, the sinking feeling of like, great. And there's always like, absolutely, there's space for bad, like not happy endings. I'm like, I love those. When that happens sometimes, like when evil wins sometimes, I'm like, okay, yeah, because that'd be what reality is sometimes. But sometimes you got to give us a break, right? It's the catharsis. Yeah. Are you trying to hurt us or are you trying to give us catharsis, right? So that was the original ending. And Peele later rewrote the ending, explaining that in the political and social state of the world, people needed a release and a hero. And this is what he had to say.
Now, I wrote this movie in the Obama era. And we were in this post-racial lie. This movie was meant to call out the fact that racism is still simmering underneath the surface. By the time I was shooting it, it was quite clear that the world had shifted. Racism was being dealt with. People were woke, and people needed a release and a hero, which is why I changed the ending and had Rod show up at the end.
Thank you, Peele. That is why I have an appreciation. That's why Chris is on my wall. I also have Nope back there. I don't have anything related yet. So if you got some cool art, let me know. But there's just it's just an amazing film. And I hope Peele doesn't make me feel so bitter for liking him soon.
Me too.
But Kat, why don't we get to you?
Yeah. So I'm going to cover a few things in my section. It's going to be a lot of like quotes as a heads up, because I just don't want to take or speak like center myself in that, I guess. So I just want to like use other people's words and amplify those words. So we're going to be discussing white liberals and performative activism. So specifically, Jordan Peele's Get Out serves as a stark reminder of the insidious nature of ingrained racism, often more perilous than overt racism. It critiques the performative and ingenuine safety many white liberals present to be perceived as good, or at the very least, avoid the label of racist, that well-intentioned white people disrupt racial progress, upholding the systems that ultimately benefit them. And it's also a call out of the lack of self-awareness many people who look like me have to the systemic and ingrained way racism has infested our minds through almost every facet of our upbringing and socialization in this country. That is something that is systemic and ruthless, and mm-hmm. looking at it, acknowledging it alone does not make it go away. That being aware is only like the first and bare minimum step. Mm-hmm. In unlearning and deprogramming that indoctrination. And we've discussed on our show many times the roots of this indoctrination in various facets of society, from schools to media, healthcare, redlining in neighborhoods and beyond. The roots of this country, the foundation it was built upon, is it. So Get Out placed the spotlight on the dangers of northern suburbs for Black Americans and the very real way white liberals cause harm. And both groups reinforced that over the years that followed. Like, after the film, it was like, oh, look, and everyone show their ass.
Yeah. And we voted for Trump. Yeah. Well, not we, but the country.
People who look like me largely did, and I'll get into that. This is harm that has been systemically erased, minimized, and or silenced whenever possible. Every episode and every day I learn of another messed up thing this country has done or is doing in the name of racism, capitalism, and white supremacy. And my goal here is to shine a spotlight on voices who have been unpacking this further and provide some like next steps, which will be at the bottom of our show notes. So a big impact that this film had, as Gabe said earlier, was that it validated the experiences of those who already knew and opened the eyes of many who didn't. And in a book titled Jordan Peele's Get Out, Political Horror, edited by Don Keatley, they say, by setting his film in a northern state, Peele's plays with our audience's own prejudices about liberalism's relation to race. The concept of good and progressive whiteness plays into the churning evil within the film and the distress viewers feel while watching this. Iris Marion Young criticizes the type of colorblindness exhibited by the Armitages, noting liberal sentiments sometimes prompt us to assert that grouping by race, sex, religion, ethnicity, region, and so on ought to carry no more significance than grouping by hair color, height, or the make of car that we drive. Such an invocation calls for groups to be considered as mere aggregates, a classification of persons according to some attribute they share. Seeing race as anything other than a political structure is to decontextualize the oppression perpetuated by that structure. The result is maintaining the status quo with regard for social framework. Whiteness in the hands of the Armitage family becomes a tool as effective and malicious as Dean's scalpel and Missy's teacup. So the point being that violence comes in many forms. Trauma is enacted in many forms. Racism goes beyond overt instances, and that even silence, complacency, well-intentioned actions can be equally damaging, perpetuating oppressive systems. The subtle harm is more insidious, catching people off guard without the emotional preparation, akin to a sucker punch, making the impact even more significant. To unpack this further, in an article on Black Feminist Collective titled Six Ways I Have Faced Anti-Blackness by White Liberals in Organizing Spaces by Stephanie Younger, Stephanie speaks to their experience with white liberals and how they witness white liberals perpetuate harm. It's a great read, so I recommend reading her words directly, as well as checking out Black Feminist Collective if you haven't already. Their website is filled with so many informative articles, as well as resources. And in the article, Stephanie discusses their experience in these spaces and the many ways white liberals disrupted those spaces by saying white liberals who claim to be anti-racist while forcing Black women into the same spaces as their overly racist counterparts, policing how we respond to oppression and speaking over us to center their own voices are part of the same problem. As long as they continue to do so, they will never see the significance in doing what it takes to act upon their claims that they practice anti-racism. She speaks to a very real issue that connects to a lot of what Jordan Peele is critiquing in Get Out. It is the best represented by the character of Rose, who in the whole film performs the role of an ally in many ways, who feigns shock and disgust when her family and family friends show their asses without holding them accountable, really. Like, she's just like, don't do that. Oh, I'm going to talk to them.
This sucks.
Yeah, you know, like, she doesn't actually hold them accountable or provide them with any kind of consequences, which is like her showing that she's a part of it. you know? Mm-hmm. So up until the end of the film, where we see how deeply they are committed to upholding and uplifting white supremacy in the depth of their betrayal of Chris, Rose is perceived as a good white person with room to grow. And in the article titled "The Scariest Part of Get Out was the Trueness to Life" by Jordy Davis on the Black Youth Project, they say, certainly, however, none of these people would see themselves as racist. Rose's father would have voted for Obama a third term. Jordan Peele thus reveals the pernicious racism behind white liberals who may celebrate the Black body, Black music, Black accomplishments, and yet still cannot see Black people as autonomous and human. So while not every white woman is kidnapping Black people for the Coagula experiment, the harm done by white women historically through words and actions centering tears or complacency is pervasive. I am not immune. White women are not immune to this problem. So performing the trappings of an ally without reconciling, unpacking, and dismantling one's own connections to the system and unconscious biases is as shallow as posting a Black square on Instagram. Without doing the work, you will, as a guarantee, end up hurting the very people you claim to want to help. And the article goes on to highlight the way historically white women will prioritize white supremacy above feminism and racial equity. So they say, despite our frontline work in the fight for liberation of all oppressed peoples, Black women are blamed for the division of the world over our valid critiques of white liberals and their participation in anti-Blackness and their loyalty to white supremacy. This is backed up by the election of Trump and white women voting for him in large percentages. They continue to say, as long as white moderates aren't affected, they are complacent with injustices that affect the most marginalized people. For example, in 2016, 52% of white female voters threw the communities Trump targeted with his racism, misogyny, etc., under the bus to preserve white supremacy. Despite the Clintons' complicity and heavy policing in Black communities, 94% of Black women who voted in the 2016 U.S. presidential election chose Hillary Clinton. Despite the anti-Blackness within the feminist movement that continued after the 2016 election, many Black women still marched in January of 2017 and continued to advocate on the front lines of many fights of gender justice, while the white women who support Trump fought against it. The reason for this is clear. Societal structures have historically prioritized race over gender, and especially in the context of white supremacy. White women, despite gender challenges, often benefit from racial privileges tied to being white. So some white women, consciously or unconsciously, prioritize preserving white-centric systems over addressing gender-based issues. This perpetuates racial inequities, lacking accountability and self-reflection. And instead of accountability, defensiveness or denial arises, leading to hypocrisy when they police Black women's responses to oppression rather than holding other white women accountable or other white people accountable. Stephanie Younger goes on to say, white liberals often see more significance in silencing Black women's legitimate critiques of those who have a vested interest in white supremacy instead of speaking to the white women who supported Trump and holding them accountable for their decisions. Black women are not often afforded the same conveniences of being oblivious to the so-called lesser evil of our oppressors. A part of being anti-racist for white people is to hold other white people accountable for their racism and for the choices that they've made that have resulted in direct harm to Black people and being a POC people in America at large. Additionally, it is holding oneself accountable for the same thing. In Younger's article, they reference another title called White Feminism is White Supremacy in Heels by Rachel Elizabeth Cargill for Harper's Bazaar. They say it's made painfully obvious that many white women believe that the worst thing that could happen to them is to be called a racist. Seeing your child gunned down in the street by a police unjustly is much worse. Being turned away from medical care due to race or underlying biases by medical staff resulting in death is much worse. Being harassed by authorities only to be challenged or charged yourself instead is much worse. And Younger continues that to get defensive and center oneself embodies the white liberal who accuses Black women of attacking them when they are not part of the community who is accustomed to be under attack. When it comes to anti-Black racism, white liberals often view themselves as exceptions, but not beneficiaries, and complicit as long as they are not actively challenging themselves. Instead of listening while I was doing the emotional labor and challenging their intentions, white liberals often said, "I'm really sorry you feel that way." Mm-hmm. White explained and policed how I should respond to the harm instead of stating how they will do better and follow through on those actions. And they saw more importance in their comfort and feelings, more significant in their good intentions, but not the negative impact of their actions have on Black lives. So in our show notes, I've cited many other articles outlining the way white liberalism is and perceived good white people can perpetuate harm in organizing spaces. And I recommend giving them a read if you'd like additional information and additional voices. I quoted like one person a lot. So like if you want other articles that kind of back that up, it is in our show notes and they're very interesting. There's also one that really stood out for me that was about how kind of like in the aftermath of 2020, seeing like where we are now in 2024 and how like with people just knowing about stuff has not made a societal impact of anything. There have been multiple instances of people reinforcing like white supremacist values. Example of Philadelphia, we have a very heavily policed area. There's a bunch of laws being passed that hurt Black people and are like definitely racist. So it's a lot happening in the world that kind of shows like the kind of backpedaling that's taken place and like kind of like the lack of dedication to actually unpacking those things and like dealing with their own roles, I guess, if that makes sense. So there's a lot to be said there. So I recommend looking at the show notes and reading those articles. The next thing I'll be covering is the hijacking and theft of Black bodies in Get Out and the impact of white supremacy on like consciousness. So another prevalent theme in Get Out is the hijacking of Black bodies and the way whiteness and corporations try to commodify and steal Black movements, bodies, and culture for economic gain and social power. When white supremacy intersects with capitalism, the results are commodification. And I have a handful of articles linked in our show notes that I recommend reading through, additionally, if you want to unpack that further. But some quotes that really stood out to me in Jordan Peele's Get Out Political Horror, edited again by John Keatley, begin in the introduction where they say, "The anxieties of Get Out, in other words, are twofold, encompassing the appropriative desire of whites for Black body, as well as the anxieties of African Americans that surviving and thriving in white society risks succumbing to white interests." And the interest of white people being to commodify the Black identity in place of overt slavery. This is seen in how white people, as well as corporations, steal Black culture, hairstyles, holidays, and movements for social and economic power, profiting socially and economically without addressing a harm, as well as like the true theft taking place. This was most recently prevalent throughout 2020. In the countless corporations and dollars spent on DEI campaigns without actual changes to board diversity or wealth distribution, as well as the hashtag Black Lives Matter messages that went out, and the commodification of Juneteenth and merchandising of both.
Yeah, I saw that Juneteenth ice cream. Yeah. And it's like they said, black is in, black is hip. That's what the order of the coagula said.
Yeah. And I mean, more recently, even considering what's happening in Palestine, is that Starbucks, in attempts to like mitigate their issues with being boycotted, essentially started to resell. They had mugs that they made previous in the year that were watermelons, and they've started actually putting them back on the shelves in attempts to get people to buy them and think that they're cool, and not actively funding genocide. So little things like that. The commodification of movements is gross, ultimately.
Yeah, there's a really famous white author. She has like this fantasy series. And she made this post on like Instagram where she was like really sad about what happened to Breonna Taylor. But it was, the post was to like promote or like launch the cover of her third book or something. And people were like, this is disgusting.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, like, in the same breath.
Yeah, do that.
That's, yeah. People will be,
yeah,
showing their asses.
Yeah. It's a lot of ignorance. And whether intentioned or not, people do show their ass. within the film, we see the very literal manifestation of this theft in the Armitage's theft of Black bodies. And in a later chapter of Jordan Peele's Get Out Political Horror titled Scientific Racism and the Politics of Looking by Kayla McNally, they speak to the exploration of scientific racism in the film, stating the coagula serves as a modern iteration of scientific racism and that both have the same goal, the control of Black bodies. I think there is value in laying bare the way scientific racism by and large encompasses an attitude that feeds into the concept of race itself, as well as the way it pervades how race is represented in Get Out. Everyone with one exception in the coagula is white, and all their documented victims are Black. This points towards the pathology within the Coagula. They don't need to verbalize their racist intent because it speaks for itself. Similarly, the discourse surrounding modern scientific racism is about abilities, metrics, environments, not about race. The lack of discussion of race, both in the film and in real life, allows plausible deniability when it comes to malicious racial intent, and it is a conversation defined as much by what is not mentioned. So in many ways, the American system acts as the Coagula, manipulating the narrative to achieve the same plausible deniability that occupied the early 2000s facade of a post-racist world. In the erasure and controlling of the narrative surrounding Black liberation and Black history, these structures seek to gaslight our perceptions of reality, kind of like the Mandela effect, and thus limit our understanding of what is, what was, and what could be. Knowing that if we do not have the context of our own history, we will not be able to understand the insidious way that the system harms the enforcers of the system, the same way institutions that create textbooks, ban books, and minimize / erase historical context surrounding American history, all with the goal of skewing our collective understanding of what the true depth of what harm is taking place in the hopes that we will not rise against it. Another point made by the Dawn Quigley introduction, it is the cost to survive a white supremacist system and the way that impacts consciousness and identity. The theft white society places on Black consciousness, specifically, they speak to, as philosopher Lewis Gordon put it, there are some, after all, who can move through the white world so long as they offer themselves as Black bodies with white consciousnesses. This can manifest in code switching and the mask that is expected of Black people who operate in white spaces to maintain. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar claimed Get Out leverages the body horror plot and invasion of the body snatchers precisely and dramatize this persistence of slavery by other means. And they say that unless the body is free from others trying to control its actions and free from constant threat of injury or death, that body, that person, that people are still enslaved. And Keatley's introduction moves on to the views of W.E.B. Du Bois, saying that they famously called the fear double consciousness, which risks becoming outright co-option. And this is manifested literally in Get Out, where the Armitages and their allies seek not only personal benefit, although that is significant, but they also want to ensure that inside every African-American is a white man pulling the strings. And Get Out, in short, is a parable of complete colonization. To unpack this further, recognizing one of the systems that perpetuates the subversion of identity in academia, and in an article titled Get Out, Structural Racism and Academic Terror by Renee Nicole Allen, they unpack the ways in which academia and law schools commodify and steal Black identity to uphold white systems and/ white benefit at the expense of Black heart. So they say, for people of color, law schools are a metaphorical sunken place. Though not literally screaming, legal scholars and law students have been telling stories of academic horror for decades. And since law schools have taken little action to address structural racism, we can conclude our screams have gone unheard. While our bodies aren't being stolen, they're being used to promote diversity and further the appearance of anti-racism. The appropriation of anti-racist rhetoric helps law schools capitalize on personal or public personas of racial justice while doing little to address the power structures that protect faculty members who, under the guise of academic freedom, inflict harm on marginalized students, staff, and faculty. In 2020, in the wake of a national reckoning with race, law schools join in the plethora of institutions espousing commitments to anti-racism. But law schools cannot satisfy their commitments to anti-racism without dismantling the policies and traditions that implicitly and explicitly perpetuate racism. In the legal academy, real-life horrors are rooted in structural racism. Anti-Black racism is present in every aspect of American life, including the legal academy. Thus, even in academic spaces, to be Black and conscious of anti-Black racism is to stare in the mirror of your own extinction. And they continue their point, kind of offering a critique of the film. If you read the entire article, which I recommend, it was actually very interesting. And as a reflection on the years following the film's release, essentially just stating that, like, unfortunately, the overall impact that we've seen in, like, since 2017 has shown that, like, seeing it is not enough. We need to be doing things. So considering anti-racism and particularly anti-Black racism, years of public displays of Black harm has resulted in minimal progress in terms of structural reform. equity and positive experiences for Black people. This is demonstrated by the fact that since the hashtag first appeared in 2013, people have continued to rally around the concept of Black people simply mattering out of the necessity as Black people continue to experience death, violent harm, explicit and implicit racism. And in 2022, despite the adoption of the hashtag Black Lives Matter as a rallying cry from people of all races, Black people in all spaces, including academia, are still expected to put trauma on display to be of importance. Of the most egregious examples of academic terror is the persistence of law professors who insist on using racial epithets to refer to Black people in total disregard for the harm of Black students and Black faculty repeatedly expressed in terms of cause, that the such terms cause. Do legal academics need multiple examples of academic terror to understand that it exists? No, and such enlightenment is not my goal or my responsibility. So if you found that section interesting, I recommend reading their entire paper on the topic. It kind of goes into like Get Out and how academia reinforces kind of like the white liberal goal. And it was very interesting, and kind of the hypocrisy of institutions and their reaction to like that film, but also like 2020 and on. So in our blog, I'll include additional reading materials for you if you want to explore those further. About all these topics, as well as some next step resources. I'll call some out just so you have them if you don't go to our blog. It is the Black Feminist Resource List from fall 2023. Has a lot of stuff. There's a Palestine Academy that kind of has a bunch of resources on how to help right now about what's happening in the genocide. The Show Must Be Paused just gives like that context of how like white liberalism impacted the Black Lives Matter movement and then like kind of ways to combat that. And the Movement for Black Lives has a website full of resources. There's Stop Cop City. There's a bunch of cop cities being built across the country. Mm-hmm. Lots of ways to stop that. There's a resource list there. I found a Black Neurodiversity resource list, which is super interesting. And then a list of anti-racism resources for those who are like trying to continuously unpack racism in the structural form and how to deal with that and how it's ingrained in our bodies. So that's the whole thing.
Yeah. I think when, you know, you were talking about like the movements of 2020, because it's really like the film was made in 2017, right? And the mm-hmm. wave of racism is gone now. Obama time was when mm-hmm. he was like, you know, writing it. Then he was making it. He was like the movements had started, right? And I think similarly, like we have the same reaction to like who is this for, right? Like who are these movements for? These demonstrations for? And as you're saying, like people know, right? Mm-hmm. All of 2020 was dedicated to revealing the violence, the horror, and it's not the first time. Right. No, like Rodney King also, revealed a lot of those horrors, too. And I will say, like 2020, 2021, a lot of that was really re-traumatizing. It was a really tense time for people who knew of those horrors, who understood that there's, you know, many a night that was just absolutely heartbreaking. It was so hard. To even get there, and even before that, right? Like mm-hmm. we covered one episode kind of like sensing that tension, and it was really rough for me to even talk about. And that was before, you know, it was before the summer, right? Before things mm-hmm. really erupted. And so it really brings me back to that, like, who is this for? And that comment of like, catharsis is for the victim, not the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And so there is some care that needs to come through with that too. Like we can't just keep inundating folks with the horrors of it and like the violence, and like that's just causing more harm every time we show like the violence that's being done to these communities, instead of being like, okay, we know, we can acknowledge that those things happen, what can we do about it? And I think also like the harm that comes from like one person was saying where there was like this controlling of the way that we react to mm-hmm. that harm, right? Like there's a perceived way that you're supposed to, like, you know, the responsible way. Mm-hmm. And especially like coming out of, you know, MLK Day, right? All the specific quotes that people choose to highlight. And they always, you know, miss out on the ones where he was saying that there's a time and a place for when we can be, you know, violent, when you can protest, when you can actually like fight back, and when you've had enough, right? And so, yeah, I think there's like so many levels to that, that just telling someone how they're supposed to feel and react to that harm is harm too. And it's like equated to those people in the film. So I think even though, you know, they weren't like the over expected villains, right? Like they weren't like the right wing nut jobs, right? They were still kind of absurd that I think so many people can look at that and be like, well, I'm not them. Mm-hmm. I'm not that bad. And it's like, but you've probably said something like this and you didn't even
absolutely know. Yeah, it's just like not recognizing the self-awareness, like what you're saying. It's not realizing the instances. If you don't have that every time that you've done something or said something messed up in your head, then you can't fix it. You know what I mean? You can't do better the next day. So it's very like the lack of self-awareness and seeing people that look like that and being like, I know no one like that, or I've never said something offensive. It's like, yes, you have. Absolutely.
I have. You know, like,
yeah, same.
And I'm like, okay, now I can learn, right? And I think like, yeah, there's especially I have these interactions with folks who are just like, that's the way it always has been, or like, that's the way I grew up. That's what, and it's just like, aren't you angry about that?
Yeah.
Why? Like, why aren't you mad? Because I'm mad. Right. Like, I'm angry that that's the way that I grew up. I'm angry that there's things that I have to unlearn, that there are things that I was taught to believe about other people and myself, like things I had to unlearn about myself. Right. And my perception of me and some like not even knowing the harm and trauma that I was going through because of these little microaggressions that like I grew up with. Right. And so for me, I'm just like, I'm angry about those things. Like, it's not like I'm angry that like you call, like if you call me racist, that's not what makes me angry. I'm angry because it's true. I'm angry because everyone is, and not everyone's doing something about it. But I'm angry that we, you know, go so far as we do with that understanding. And so for me, it just like makes me crazy when people are like, that's just how it is. Like, isn't that infuriating?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
That's how it
don't
is.
You it hate that? That like, because that says more to me, like, because it's not an excuse, right? Like, it's not a defense. It's just an explanation. Basically, that's how it's always been. Like, yeah, that sucks. So what are you doing now?
Yeah,
like, you could still grow.
That.
Like, you could still be better. So.
And it's also, like, a lack of recognition that, like, another way did exist before. We made all of this up. So we can undo all of those things and do a different thing that's allowed.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to do it that. Just because it's been this way for the last hundreds of years does not mean we need to keep doing that.
Yeah. Or even like, you know, when people think of like ICE, right? And the fact that they've been here for a blip of time and people like treated them like they were a foundation of our country. And they're not, right? Like, we don't need them. They are babies. And
because racism is a foundation of our country. Yeah. But they're like,
of course.
The police already were doing that. But
yeah. Yeah. No, I think, just such a, that's how things have always been. Okay. Yes. And like facts continue. What else can we do about that, friend? Absolutely. So
a lot of things.
So many things. First of all, just acknowledge. I think great episode, Kat. Good job.
You too, man.
As always, you know, I love, you know, hearing from your section and learning things, or hearing from other people too, like kind of sharing those resources. Definitely check out the blog for more information. We'll be linking things. Like I said, check out Princess Weeks, because that was just a great piece, and just other things that she does is really great. We've definitely referenced her before. So lifting that up, because you're doing the work, and I think that's great. Yeah, and we we have more of this series. We will not be covering Nope during this series. You know, we're, as much as we love covering Jordan Peele, just because like his works are so great, and I really do love Nope. It's over there on my wall.
Yeah.
It just doesn't fit here because this is a new year, new me. Series. And unfortunately, the new me was going to be white people in your body. So, but we like terrible white people in your body. Not to be mean, Kat, I don't think anybody'd be taking your body.
Oh, it's broke. Yeah, it's made of garbage.
If anything, that's okay. You'd be like, can I come in there? No, I'm kidding. Yeah. is there a new body I could be in? No,
I'd like a robot one, not a human that already exists one.
Yeah. Who we forced to be a passenger in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Nope doesn't fit. But we'll have some other ones coming up. And, you know, I hope you enjoy it. Let us know what you think of Get Out. If there's things, again, filmmaking things, language, color theory, props in the background, like whatever you want to highlight. I love that stuff. I'm such a sucker for those things. And that's why, like, I geek out so hardcore for something like Get Out and Us. Like a lot of things you were referencing for this and how it was like. Like, you know, the medical experiments and the control of these bodies. I was like, that's us. Like, he just, like, expanded. He was like, there's a whole, you know,
kept going,
class of people who were, you know, being abused. But but it's there because, unfortunately, those things are linked. And there's a reason for it. So thank you for watching this, you know, slightly longer than usual episode. These ones have aired towards, like, you know, longer anyway. And
don't get married. There's lots to say. Don't get married though with your kids, yes.
Yes, there's a lot to say. We'll just leave it at that. Some of these get really sad. Or your kid totally ruins the plans of a cult and fights back. And now I guess we just have to figure out what to do about the rest of the Coagulas.
Yeah. Yeah, and I did like... In the ideal scenario, she would be murdered. Everybody. That's what we would have been better.
Or
not better, but like in real life, better.
Yeah, maybe he'll go to court. But we saw how like even the black cops reacted. Like it was very clear that the system of justice was not going to serve. In this scenario. I don't even think he could talk about it because.
Yeah.
Then they would know.
Yeah.
That he killed them. I will say, though, probably a benefit is that most likely she never posted him.
That he was there. Yeah.
Like, or nobody knew they were together besides Rob, probably. And so he'd be like, oh, shame. Shame what happened to those rich white people in the woods. Okay. All right. Bye, y'all. Bye.